amplifiez votre passion pour la guitare pour quelques euros par mois. Rendez-vous sur lachaîneguitare.com. Amplify your passion for the guitar for a few dollars per month. Head over to theguitarchannel.biz. Excellent. Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the Zoom connection the one and only Jeff McAlane from Brooklyn. So Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks, Pierre. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's really a pleasure to have you. It would be even better to be side by side and have you here at the showroom in Paris, but eventually it will happen. But Now we have to use Skype, Zoom and FaceTime and all that good stuff. So tell me, Jeff, we are going to talk about now the album you released. I think it was in 2019, but you have to tell me, what was your very first guitar?
An Ibanez Roadstar.
Oh yeah, I remember those one. It's kind of
like a strat guitar.
So you start right at the beginning. It was an electric guitar for you.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I started when I was dating myself. We had sent away. I conned my parents into sending away for the home guitar course, which was like an album, and I had a little crappy guitar, and I played it lefty, and
okay.
I couldn't understand any. So in frustration of like an 8-year old, and I couldn't, they said, first we need to tune up, and they're playing the note, you know, the E string. And I'm like, you know, 8 years old. So I gave it up until I was about, I guess about 13. And then it was just the obsession pretty quickly after that, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on your career, what are the main turning points you can, you know, detect and tell us about that were very important about how you became the musician you are now?
You mean like musically turning points or like
training, influences, important projects, stuff like that?
Oh, sure. Well, the funny thing is I always wanted to play guitar before I played guitar. Like I was just immediately always gravitated towards thinking it was the coolest thing. And I have an older brother, and that's always kind of influential in terms of what I would listen to. So there was always music in the house. And I remember my dad had brought home a big stereo system at one point, and he was playing Sgt. Pepper through it. And I remember thinking, this is really cool. And that record was out for, you know, a number of years, obviously, before I had heard it. You know, it came out, I think, when I was born. I just remember being really thinking, this is really cool. And then I started to discover my own music. It was Zeppelin.
Okay.
From my older brother, and hearing certainly Stairway to Heaven and thinking this is the coolest thing. And then Queen and Brian May, and that was it, you know. And then the real turning point, I was listening to that, and then I started getting into heavier stuff like Rush at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered, in my mind, I really got into Black Sabbath, and then Ozzy's first record was that was a pivotal moment for me as a guitar player, when I first heard Mr. Crowley.
You know? Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then Iron Maiden and Judas Priest. So I grew up being a metalhead, you know, which I still am. that kind of era. I just told people, I was surprised, like, oh, you're like a blues guy. I'm like, yeah, you know.
Kind of.
That's a part of what I do. But for me, my earliest influences were classic blues rock guys, which I still love, and then the metal guys.
Mm-hmm. What was your training? Are you completely self-taught? Did you have some teachers or?
Yeah. I always had teachers. You know, growing up, my parents, you know, were like, you got to take lessons, and they were very supportive. So, my father passed away when I was really young, and my mother was super supportive the whole time, because I think she figured out that there was nothing else I was interested in. So, as long as I wasn't doing things I shouldn't be doing. So I always took lessons, and I owe a lot of credit to you. I have still one of my best friends of all time. His name is Chris Amelaar, unfortunately fairly unknown, but just a spectacular musician, perfect pitch, great guitar player. And he was my closest friend, and he would always kind of be pushing me forward. So the two of us had this really great friendship of just showing each other stuff. And I think that was at the heyday of the guitar magazines and instructional videos, and you know, that things suddenly became very accessible, so you could get into what Yngwie was doing and try to learn that. And then after that, I went to music school. I went to Berklee.
Okay. College in England. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at what age did you know, or did you decide, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to become a professional musician.
13.
Okay.
I remember my aunt, I have a family in Scotland, and I was lucky. I had stayed at my aunt and uncle's. They had a farm that my uncle was working. And, you know, my aunt was like, she reminds me, I guess I was about, 13. I was like, well, what do you, the neighbor asked what I want to do when I grow up. And I said, oh, I want to be a professional musician and maybe play as a studio musician or be in a rock band or, you know, Broadway. Okay. And they were like, what, you know? And it never changed really, you know, for the most part, what I wanted to do. So, so I'm fortunate in that sense that I knew early on what it is I wanted to do, and it never really changed, you know.
Mm-hmm. And who are the, I don't know, the main two or three guitar player, and you know, in the pantheon you have?
Oh, Robin Ford.
Okay.
You know,
big surprise.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about. There's so many fun things, you know, when you get to become friends with your hero and start working with them, and you know, he's one of my close friends now, and so that's something we can talk about, which is a ton of fun. Michael Schenker, one of my favorite guitar players. I still absolutely love Michael Schenker. It's hard to know. And Jeff Beck. Like, I think if you said, you know, who is your absolute all-time favorite, it's probably Jeff and Robin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, there's so many. It's hard to narrow it down.
Yeah, sure. So tell us, how did you meet Robin, and what's your story with him?
It's a fun story. We had met once or twice in guitar workshops and things, and you know, just passing and saying hi. I do a lot of instructional courses with True Fire, and I'm very, really, they're great people. I've known them. I've been there since sort of the beginning of them. And as they grew, they said to me one day, "Hey, we got Robin Ford. He's really interested in doing it." And I said, and I've told Robin a story. I said, "Are you going to allow him just to do the same course he always does?" And they're like, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, you know, he's brilliant, but sometimes I don't think people ask him the right questions that I want to know, because they just let him do what he wants to talk about."
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, I would love to ask him specific questions. And so the owner of True Fire, Brad Winkos, had said, "All right, you're hired. You're going to produce the course with me."
Okay, cool.
And then, so I wrote out, we did this big, long thing. We sent out, to all the True Fire fans, what you would like to ask Robin, and I had put together specific questions, and then we met and we came down to True Fire, and Robin was like, "Who came up with these questions?" And I said, "That would be me."
I don't
He's
want
like,
to
these
tell
are
my secrets.
Great questions. Okay. Yeah. He's like, "These are great questions." I'm like, "Well, I know you're playing really well, and these are the questions I've always wanted to ask you." So it worked out well, and then we really hit it off. And then we both taught at a guitar workshop in Montana. He was the visiting guest and I was on the faculty. And he had not heard me play. And then he came to my class and he was super complimentary. He's like, I didn't know you could play. You know? So you know what I mean? And we just became friends. And then the big connection was he was doing his guitar dojo, the teaching thing each year. And it was in New York City, or outside of New York, in Woodstock, and I live in Brooklyn. And he just called me. I said, "Hey, man, you know, would you like to do this with me?" And I said, "Sure." So it's a small group of people, and I had a number of students, and I brought in a bunch of people, and we made it very successful. And we'd been doing that for about 4 years together and sold it out every year. And then this one day we're hanging out and talking. He's like, "Hey, you want to do a record together?" And I'm like,
"Yeah, sure, no problem."
"Yeah, sure, all right, why not?" Yeah, sure. So what's been fun with he and I is it's been a really good friendship and a really good working relationship, in the sense of I've helped kind of push him to get more online and to be more active and to touch with his bass, and he's really enjoying that. And what he's done for me is obvious, you know, like he's brought me into his world and playing gigs with Tos Panos and Jimmy Haslip, you know, guys I grew up loving, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Who are now guys that I have the great fortune to call friends and to play with.
So, mm-hmm. so and do you think you were able to get all the secrets you wanted to have from him through your question, or there are still some secrets you need to dig?
Well, he is a endless well of amazingness, you know, and I've said this before, as good as you think he is, he's even better.
Okay.
Is when you're in a room with it and you're just hanging out on the couch, like I stay at his house when I go down, you know, like I said, we're friends and we're just kind of playing, he'll just play something and I'm like, yeah. Yeah. Or I'll write some, him working on this, he's like, well, you could do this with it. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I could do that. You know? So, what I was very happy with is the people who've been to the gigs, they thought it was a good relationship on stage because we don't play the same way. And it was interesting for me to hear him play and go, okay, I have to erase him from my playing mm-hmm. when I'm playing with him, because mm-hmm. then it sounds like poor, like a diminished lick, you know, some of those diminished things. On a gig with him, I'm not touching that stuff. You know, it's just my own thing. But he was always super supportive about me doing my own thing. And I think on the first gig, I was really intimidated because there was no rehearsal. You know, there was like a sound check and then we're doing gigs. And I'm on there with Jimmy Haslip and Tos Panos, and I'm just a little intimidated, you know, and this, and he could feel it. And he's like, hey man, you remember you're not here because you're my friend. You're here because I want you to play the guitar the way you play guitar.
Okay,
you
know? So and get to work and play now. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I have nothing but great stuff to say about him. He's such a great player. But in terms of the well of stuff, like, you know, I think, I'm sure you know, everybody knows him for his lead playing, but the rhythm guitar playing,
mm-hmm.
that's the thing that's influenced me most that I really learned on stage and just hanging out playing with him to go, oh, he is one of the best rhythm guitar players. That sounds like I'm, you know, overly gushing, but it's really the experience I play with a lot of people, and him playing rhythm guitar is unlike anybody else, mm. you know.
You have a guitar in your hand. Can you give us an example of typical, I don't know, rhythm guitar playing by Robin and maybe compare it to what you would do?
Oh, yeah. Okay. For instance, say we're just talking about like a minor blues, you know, something simple, you know, like a minor blues, say everything like B minor, right? This is really kind of more like Robin.
Okay.
Like the really super rhythmic, kind of going through these inversions and throwing in, you know, lots of fills, but it feels busy sometimes, but when you play with them, it's just not. It's this really fascinating thing of, he always seems to be supportive in the best way. And whereas maybe in the past I would have been more like, you know, and you know, there's something really super simple. And he would do that. He never overplays, but simple things that I never thought, you know. You know, those kind of really, he's just carrying it through, and you hear a lot of that Motown influence and the funk stuff. And instructionally wise, it's all his right hand. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out some of these things to him, that when he plays rhythm guitar, the most fascinating things I discovered from him was he plays really, really loud.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Really? Mm. Yeah.
I have a story about that, because I saw him play live at Issoudun, right in the middle of France, and I was way back at the in the room, and there were some people complaining, oh my God, it's too loud, and Robin basically laughed and said, well, you know what, that's the way I play, that's it. So when you say he plays loud, yeah, definitely he's loud, yes.
It was a shock for me, because even playing in metal bands, you know, living in New York, you cannot play that loud playing the kind of gigs I've been doing. And anybody who's not either doing their own gig or of that generation where people play that loud back then, you know, it was just a little bit older. Whereas for me, if I went into a club in New York and turned up, you know, used a 100-watt dumbbell, forget it, you know. So on stage, it was very disorienting at first. It was like, oh my God, like, we're going to go there. So I had to get, that's when I knew my relationship with T Rock really came to fruition too. I called them up and they're like, well, we'll just get you 100-watt, you know, because I wasn't 100-watt amp for me in New York City. It was like, what? You know, okay. Like I have my old Marshall behind me that never, it's like a, it just stays at home because you can't bring that around. But so in terms of what I found most fascinating is that he never touches the volume knob at all.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. So he just all on the dynamic of his right hand then.
Yeah. So specific things that he does, he plays with the back rounded side of the pick. And when he plays rhythm guitar, and so he's scratching. If you listen to his playing, you hear a lot of this kind of, like this kind of scratchy sound to it. And that's because he's using the rounded side of the pick and he rolls it back around. And so getting into some of those things and ironically pointing them out to him. You know, I'm like, you don't realize you do this? And he's like, no, I never noticed I did that. And I'm like, well, you should talk about that when you're teaching, you know, because it's a big element of the playing. So those are things that really influence me now moving on, that I'm like, oh, I never thought to do that. And so those are things when you start hearing his playing. And these things just develop. It's just the way he plays guitar. I never thought about it, just the way it happened.
Yeah. I stumbled the other day on an interview you gave. I think it was on Tim Pierce's YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
And it was around the Les Paul, right? It was the theme of the interview. Yeah. So you would define yourself definitely as a Les Paul guy?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting. Well, lately, back and forth. I grew up playing like Jacksons and Charvels and, you know, and then definitely a Strat guy for the most of my life. And what was interesting when I started playing with Robin, and I've talked about this in other interviews, we had done some gigs and he's like, you should stop playing a Strat. Like, what? You know? And he's got some prejudice against Strat, but at the time I think he was really on to something. He's like, very complimentary. He's like, you know, you sound great, but you go to that neck pickup and then you start sounding like Hendrix. Like, I don't mean I sound like Hendrix, but suddenly you're playing a Strat. Like, it's very clear to him. And that's a great sound. I love the neck pickup on a Strat. I mean, you know, it's, excuse me, when I was on the road with him and since he was producing your record, he's like, I don't want you to play Strat on the record at all. Like, let's go for something different. So I really just started digging into playing the Les Paul. And I'm really happy he said those things, because I look back in retrospect, being a big Jeff Beck fan, I was doing things that were so ingrained in my playing, like using the bar, you know, that I think I sound a little bit more with my own voice now, even when I go back to the Strat, by not relying on those things that are not distinctly mine. I love like Mike Landau, and there's things I would do that I'm like, and he would even say, he's like, it's kind of like Landau a bit, right? And I'm like, He's like, hey, he's playing that Strat. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, okay. And then when he talks, I'll listen. I think, you know, obviously he was coming from the kindest of places, you know what I mean? So now when I play a Strat, I think I play it differently than I did. So I'm happy, you know, I've got my old Strat, which
Ooh,
is
nice.
Yeah, that was the big investment of my lifetime right here. You know, I love it, and so it's sort of the it's great, you know. So I love both, but sometimes lately I've just been gravitating towards Les Paul,
because
I've learned how to play it. And if that makes sense.
On that interview with Tim, you also said that you tell a story where you bought a Les Paul, a vintage Les Paul from Robin, right? You have to show it to us. Ooh, my God. Yeah. So is that the Holy Grail for you?
Yeah, it's a 53. He was playing for a long time. I see him playing it. And, you know, there was a bunch of things that came into play. Like he said, you know, I was looking into something vintage on Les Pauls. It's just too expensive. It's just, you know. And we just had a nice conversation and he's like, let's, you should have this. You got over the P90s, I think. And he's always searching for stuff. And so we just worked out something that he made it possible for me to get it. And I pulled in as many favors as I could and liquidated a lot of things and, you know, really stretched it. But I felt like with these situations, with the old Strat and that old Les Paul, you know, it's their investments. And so if I ever, I play them, and at some point, you know, if you need to unload them, then you just do what you got to do, you know? And it, they're both player grade levels, you know what I mean? They're not museum pieces. They're so, and as he said, he's like, players should be playing these things, not collectors, you know? So
yeah, very true. And what about the Les Paul you are holding at the moment? Is that a vintage piece or a reissue?
No. It just looks like it. It's historic makeovers. Did this. So it's just a 2019
okay.
or 18. Like, so the newest, it's the 30th anniversary, the latest Les Paul that they put out for the 59. And Historic Makeovers is a company down in Florida. And what they do, I've had, as I said in the Tim Pierce interview, I've had the great opportunity of working with somebody who owns, part of my job with this person was to help him choose out his vintage guitar collection.
Nice.
Which is like one of those things.
Pretty good job.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
You know? You know, it's just one of those weird things that came through the, you know, somebody I knew this person. It was actually David Grissom, who's a very good friend of mine, introduced me to this guy. He was working with this band, and I started teaching the guy because David's like, I'm producing and co-writing the record. You should teach this guy. And then this thing expanded, and I was lucky enough to be in a room with 5 59 bursts and being able to play them. And he's like, just choose the two you like the most. I'm like, what is going on? You know, this is,
you know. Am I dreaming or what? Yes.
Yeah. So it was just, you know, one of those funny things that can happen and did happen. So my point is, I got a chance to play a lot of old, you know, a lot of vintage instruments, and some of them are just terrible. You know, because they're wood, and so some of them, when you get to play a few Holy Grail items, you start to go, oh, okay. And so Historic Makeovers, what they do is they strip the guitar entirely. They put new binding on it. They put a Brazilian fingerboard on it. This is true nitro, and they use the same dyes. So it's as close feeling to the real deal as I've ever played, and I could never afford the real deal. And if somehow one of them appeared in my front door, I would have to sell it immediately because the insurance alone on it, you know. So I find the Historic Makeover is the closest I've come to the real thing.
And do you think that if you were blindfolded and you were playing either that guitar or a good 59, you would be able to hear the difference, or maybe you would be able to feel it, but would you be able to hear it if someone else would be playing the two guitars, for example?
Probably. If it's a great one. Okay. You know what I mean? Because like I said, I've played a few 58s and 59s, and I was like, nah, I wouldn't buy this, period. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not a great guitar, what you look for. So I've played this next to his, and I've been very happy.
Okay.
You know, I'm just like, okay, I'm done. I'm extremely happy with it, and I will never own. You know, the price differential between like a 2 humbucker 57 on is quite different than a 53 with the wonky bridge and all the things you have to think about. So, so I'm really, you know, honestly, it's all in your hands anyway. You know, you could have the greatest guitar in the world, and if you can't really play very well or not aware of the sonic things, it just doesn't really matter. Now, if I A-B'd my vintage Strat next to my Michael Tuttle guitars, which are great, there is a difference. But not all the Strats are different, you know, that much of a difference. And I think some of it comes down to the old wood and, you know, all those mystery things. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about now. So the album was released somewhere in 2019. So I listened to it a lot to prepare for this interview. And really the sound of the record is great. The songs are there are a lot of different kind of music, instrumental and songs and so on. So what was the idea behind the album you wanted to record?
Well, interestingly, the album came out, we were doing those workshops, like I said, and we would jam every night. And some of those songs that we played on that record, two of them were on my first record. But he just liked them so much. And there's one called It's Your Groove that was, reminded me of, it's a very Miles Davis-ish kind of thing from that, the period I love, Star People, you know, with John Scofield and... that 80s and 70s Miles, and Robin really loved that tune. He's like, we got to do that one. And so, of course, I'm going to do it with him because it's going to be a different thing. He wrote half the songs and I wrote half the songs. So it's like a duo record, you know, but he wanted it to be my record. Mm-hmm. He's call it yours, it's your record, because, you know, he's not singing on it. Partly because he's a great guy and he wanted it to be my record. And also it's his fan base. He can't put out too many records under his name, yep. You know, those kind of things like that. So he wrote half the tunes and I wrote half. And then the vocal tunes were his idea. I was thinking all instrumental and he really wanted to throw some vocals on. So, you know, let's see what happens. We went down to Nashville and recorded it in a fairly short period of time. And I came back here and redid some of the guitars, which I probably wouldn't do again. I would probably just live with what happened down in Nashville to keep some of the my obsessive compulsive tendencies at bay, you know. And then we did some touring on it. We did two tours, short tours, like 2 weeks, in the States, and it was great. We had planned. We started discussing a second record, and then COVID hit, and that kind of put everything on the back burner. And we had a number of dates lined up. For this year that he asked me to do, and that didn't happen.
Yeah. So can you pick one of your song on the record and explain us if you have a specific process to compose, or what was the initial raw idea for the song? Was it a melody? Was it a chord progression?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
how it evolved?
Well, let's talk about when I specifically composed for the record, you know, which is a Strat song in my mind. Hold on. If I'm in tune, you know. I didn't have any pedals in, but that.
What was the initial idea? Was that that kind of melody, or?
Yeah, so I wanted to write something new for the record, and so I had heard the song actually a lot faster, and I sent the demo to Robin, and he's like, oh, let's just slow that one way down. And the process for it, I think, at some points is I just stumble across something. You're kind of noodling. I wanted to write something in six. I really like playing stuff in six. Mm-hmm. Maybe too much. So, and then I wanted to, I like that, it sounds kind of like Americana-ish, which I really love that kind of thing. And then I wanted to bring it a little further jazzy-wise or harmonically to add some tension to it. I think my songwriting is fairly simple. You know, I've always gravitated towards, I mean, I love Alan Holdsworth, but I can't write anything like that. I just don't.
Nobody can, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I asked Jimmy Haslip, I'm like, how did you remember those tunes? He's like, I just went with it. And I'm like, what? Yeah. What does that mean, you know? He's like, after a while, you just kind of, you hear where it's going. I'm like, okay, that's why you played with him, you know, for so long, and Jimmy Johnson. But, you know, I love, like, Tom Waits. I just love strong, simple songwriting. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most powerful thing to me. And I think when I try to become too clever, it doesn't really work. I feel like I'm forcing it. And so I just had that section, and I was kind of stuck on a B section for a little while. And then it kind of came to me that, you know, I was like, well, God, I keep screwing up today. So I've played this song in ages. It's amazing. So, that thing, and I really love, I feel like some of my music is a little more cinematic. Mm-hmm. I feel like these things, not just because they're instrumentals, but I like kind of creating some sort of image in my head or somebody else's head, hopefully. And those are my favorite sort of things. And I always love that about Jeff Beck, his instrumentals. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that's, you know, they're impossible to play or very difficult to play the way he plays them, but there's nothing that's overly complicated. I think it's just the strongest thing for me is if it's got a melody.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. it. It trumps everything else. Mm-hmm. I don't care. And then the older I get, the less and less I care about the other stuff. I just want to engage people and create something mm-hmm. that, I think one of the best compliments I've gotten on some of my stuff on my records is my wife likes it.
Okay.
You know,
she's
not
a tough
just
customer.
Guitar nerd stuff necessarily. You
she's
know?
A tough customer to please. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And when do you know that the song is done and ready to be recorded? Is there
sometimes
a green light
popping
in your?
Sometimes you know, and sometimes you need someone to say, "Okay, it's
okay.
done."
Okay. Stop. Next. Okay.
Yeah. You know, and this is where Rob was super helpful. I sent him a bunch of ideas of songs, and he was like, "Yeah, you can do better."
Okay.
And that's good because I think, you know, in the world, I was having this conversation with Tim Pierce about some artists that we like, and he was like, yeah, I really like the record, but back in the day, that's those 3/4 of those songs wouldn't have made it to the record because they were too similar to the others, mm-hmm. or, you know, a good producer would have browbeaten them, you know, write 5 more songs before we do that, you know, mm-hmm. keep on doing it. So I think in the era of doing everything at your house, sometimes you don't have that person pushing you to say, yeah, you can do that a little better. So it was nice to, I'm all proud of this song, and Rob was like, eh. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could do it if you want.
So, and how did you work with Robin? I mean, was it the opposite? Okay, yeah, okay, play a solo, Robin. Oh, no, okay, I think you can do better than that, Robin. Or
not as much, but... at one point, yeah, there's a few ideas he wanted to put on the record. Oh, okay. There was one where he uses a pog now sometimes, you know, to get this sound. And some people love it and some people don't. And I am, oddly, the guy who's sort of responsible for
it. Okay.
He was looking at my pedal board and I had an Octavia and he's like, what's that? And then I have my Univibe and he's like, what's that? So I helped him choose some pedals. Mm-hmm. And so he took a pog solo in a record. And then in another song he did, I'm like, no, you get one. You get one.
Okay.
He's like, really? No, I like it. I'm like, I know you like it, but you get one. You know? Because so, I wanted him like, no, I'm not. Just play regular guitar on this. Mm. You know?
And how did you split the guitar parts from on your song or on Robin's song?
Well, interesting. There's a song in a record called 1968 that Robin wrote, but he insisted I solo on it, you know, and which was... cool, because this is your record. I'm happy to write the song. And that song was really challenging for me to solo because it was changes that he would write, you know. And I mean this in the most, hopefully sounding humble, like I worked on a lot of that song to really make those changes because we were in the studio. The first time we played it was in the studio. And he's like, oh yeah, just solo over this. And I'm like, wait, I can't just solo over this right now. It changes keys every bar, you know? Like, and he's like, oh, I guess it does, doesn't it? You can just hear your way through it, right? And I'm like, no. Like, so I took it home and worked through that one. And then I sent him the solo and he's like, it sounds a little like Larry Carlton. I'm like, is that a bad thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was a nice compliment. And because it was a very Steely Dan-esque kind of changes. So that was a challenge for me on that one. To, like I said, do on the spot. I listened back to someone on the spot there, and it's not something I would have wanted to have kept. But we just basically decided who was going to solo and what. I do get more of the solos, but I was pretty insistent as well. There was another song he didn't want to solo, and I'm like, no. We both need to solo on this one because it'll be fun because you're going to do your thing. And then we figured out, it's like, all right, I'll solo on the B section and you solo on the A section. We just worked out where it made the most musical sense.
Mm-hmm. What about who had the idea to re-record Albatross, which is a gorgeous song, which sounds, the melody is so simple, it must be super hard to re-record, no?
Yeah, well, it's one of those interesting ones. I love Peter Green, and I was... And so does Robin, and we were talking about it, and I wanted to do, we're going to have some vocals. We had a lot of ideas floating around, and I learned a lot, and he learned a lot. That was like one of the first records that he produced under his own thing. We put it out on his label, and so I learned a lot, and he learned a lot, in terms of how these things go. So we were looking for a cover. And he's like, why don't we do like somebody like Peter Green? Let's maybe do something like that. And I'm thinking, well, maybe we could do Oh Well and just kind of really stretch out on it. And he's like, why don't we just do Albatross? And I was like, well, it's the interesting thing about Albatross in the States, it was not the big hit that it was in Europe,
okay,
or at least in England.
Interesting.
So for us to play, for me, I'm like, oh yeah, Albatross, great. And then when I talk to my friends in England, like, you're gonna do Albatross? Like,
are you crazy?
Like, that was, yeah, you're just like, that's a big thing. And then so for me as a Peter Green fan, early Fleetwood Mac, it's a big thing. But in terms of any sort of taboo level of it, there was none for us. We just thought we'd just give it a shot. And the reason why I jumped on it with him was because I love the tune, and I actually asked that Rob, I'm like, have you ever played harmony with anybody on a record and guitar? He's like, not that I remember. So okay. I just thought it would be kind of fun to see I in the studio together, looking at each other, playing the part. So for me, that song was, I love the tune, but it was about a moment, of doing something that we both liked a lot.
Yeah, and it's a great version. So can you tell us about some of the tone toys you used on the record? Because throughout all the song, the guitar sounds are awesome. So what did you use?
Oh, thank you.
And don't tell me it's all in the hand, okay?
So for me, it was primarily 2 amps. There's 3 amps on there, the ones that are behind me. It's the classic reverb signature, the 2 Rock. Which is the first 2 Rock I got, which is great. It's the one that Matt Schofield helped kind of create, and it's John Mayer using it, and then Doyle Bramhall. And I know the guys at 2 Rock really well, and they're such great people. And I have my old 72 Super Lead.
Okay.
So that's on It's Your Groove. Mm-hmm. That's this.
Mm.
And then in the middle of doing some of the overdubs, I ended up getting a Bloomfield drive, which is a bit more dumbly, and that's somewhere on the record. So so a lot of it was that, and I got the aux. So some of the stuff you're hearing, since I live in Brooklyn, I can't crank up an amp.
And
so some of the stuff is the aux. And when I listen back, I feel like I can make it sound better now, because there's a huge learning curve with all these sorts of things. So I'm happy enough with those tones. Of course, Robin's were all cut like in one day on his dumble in the studio, I'm just going to play it and all right, but I learned a lot from that, that's just the way I've got to do it. And if you listen to him play, there's a few, I don't want to say mistakes, but he's not worried about it. Whereas, if I made like a clink, I would be, they're all over the place on when he's playing, but you don't hear it because it's the big, the big flow and the big picture. So, in retrospect, I would lean more towards that and less obsessing.
Okay.
In terms of those amps on the aux in the studio, it was the 2 Rock through a Marshall 412 on basically all the rhythm guitar parts. Most of the rhythm guitar parts were in the studio. Marta, I redid, that's the song I fumbled through here. I redid because I wasn't happy with the clean guitar sound that we got in the studio, and I thought it could take a little more. It deserves better, you know, the song. So I did that here with the two rock and a tremolo, and you know, worked through that.
Mm-hmm. And the drive we hear is mm-hmm. all coming from the amp, or did you use some overdrive pedal here and there?
Yeah, primarily the amp, and there's two overdrives that I really love, and I the Vemuram Shanks OD1, mm-hmm. which is sort of my favorite as an overdrive pedal goes, and a Klon.
Okay.
You know, that I have a KTR, and I actually have an original that I was smart enough to never sell when I first got it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of those only thing I was smart enough not to get rid of. You know? So I got it in the 90s, and I didn't use it for a long time. Actually, you know what happened was I had one in the 90s, and I sold it, and I really missed it, and I got another one when you could still get them for, you know, a reasonable price. And so I held on to that, fortunately. Mm-hmm. But the way the prices are going now, I'm like, you know, yeah. That would be really, do I need that? Mm. So that and the Univibe on the record is an old full tone Univibe.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the delay would be post, you know, but if I recorded with delay, a few things I recorded live with a delay, and that is a Strymon El Capistan.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really love the sound of that pedal. And a full tone Super Trem and the full tone Octafuzz that I've been using for years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the main setup.
Mm-hmm. And what about the guitars? Was it the guitar?
This was not on the record. This okay. came after the record. I can actually show you what was on the record. So it's a Les Paul that I did sell. Okay. I had a Gold Top that I sold that I had to sell to.
That's life.
To get yeah. this, which is worth every penny of reselling. It's Your Groove. Since it didn't play a Strat, this guitar was on the record a lot. It's a Michael Tuttle Telecaster, but it's got a Firebird pickup in the neck.
Okay.
So I really like that. This guitar was on the record a lot, and a Gold Top reissue with humbuckers that I had sold.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, I was out without a Les Paul for a while after I got this, because mm-hmm. I had to liquidate. It was worth it, you know, because okay. I knew that I would just recover at some point. But it was the opportunity rose, and it was a funny story of, saw the guitar on Reverb. A friend of mine said, hey, man, there's an old Strat on Reverb. I'm like, yeah, well, you know.
And what's the year of this one again?
64.
Okay.
So, of the... of the pre-CBS, 64 and 65, they get more desirable the earlier the years mm-hmm. go.
Yeah.
So super snobby people say like, well, you know, it's got the veneer board, but you know, it's John Mayer's favorite 64, you know, and it sounds amazing. I love it. It's great. So, you know, some people don't like the bursts on these and all that because they chain. I don't care. And I can't afford a 54, you know, or something like that. So I saw it in Reverb, and I saw the guy was in Brooklyn. So I texted him, and he said, well, let's talk offline. Where do you live? And he turns out he literally lives around the corner.
Okay.
So I went, I'm like, wait a minute. And I went over to the house, and it was a nice situation where he had a few of my True Fire courses, and he had the record. So he was like, oh, I know who you are. I didn't know you realized you lived in the neighborhood. And so... you know, he didn't have to go through a store, so there wasn't the, you know, we worked out a good deal mm-hmm. on the guitar, and it's all original except for the switch, which is fine because I put in a five way,
yeah,
and it had original frets on it, which was unplayable, you know, and I just moved the tone knob to the bridge,
okay,
so there's no tone in the middle, sound like the Eric Johnson thing.
Mm.
And it's just, I had it refretted with 6105s, you know, big, taller frets. And I'm just, it's, you know, hopefully it'll be the lifetime guitar. I'm glad I did it. And now the price is, I mean, there's all those times in your life when these things in the 80s, when everybody's playing Charvels, were going for nothing.
Yeah,
you know, nobody cared.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so now again, they're out of the price range. They've jumped up. So I'm happy to have one. And, you know, it was worth, you know.
And it seems to be very loud when you play, when you strum it with the volume at zero, acoustically, it seems to be super loud. Yeah.
Right. When I went to his house and played it, I was like, what? You know, and I played a number of them that were not really that great. And sonically, reverb soaked at the moment. You know, it's really, it sounds good in all the positions, which is not something you always come across with the Strat. And having played a bunch of vintage ones, like, oh, the neck sounds better, or the bridge is great. Mm. And this one, it's got that great Knopfler, you know. So I'm very happy. Neck. And so every time I pick it up, and this was like Robin's doing, you know, after playing his Tele and going, oh man, this is, I had his Tele at my house for 2 weeks. We did a gig in New York. He's like, can I just leave this with you? And I'm like, what?
No.
Yes, I'm like, sure. Okay. And then I'll be back. I just got to head out of the country. Do you mind just grabbing it? And I'm like, all right. So that was one of those moments where I played it. And I'm like, wow, this is really just kicks all my guitar's butts.
Really? Okay.
A great guitar. Mm-hmm. And his, you know, he and a few other people were like, well, you know, you play professionally, is what you do, and a great instrument is a great instrument. And I find it super inspiring every time I play it. You know, you pick it up and it does what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I'm justifying it, but you know, when you decide to make that move, it's very difficult.
But if it's worth it, that's all that matters in the end. So that's good.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So we are still in the middle of the crazy pandemic situation. So you are obviously a professional musician. What is paying the bill at the moment? Because there is no tour. How did you adapt through this situation?
Well, interestingly, I had been teaching all along, and I've been teaching online for a really long time. And the True Fire courses and instructional things, I kind of, as a career path, gave up touring. I had done it a lot. I was touring in the 90s and early 2000s in Europe a lot. And you come off the road, you have a few dollars, and then you're without work and you're struggling again, and then you go back on the road. And after I got over 40, I was thinking, this is really, you know, the music business had changed a lot. And I just decided I didn't want to do that anymore. I want to tour and play. I want to play, but the cost of going on the road wasn't really worth it for me anymore. And, you know, you never reach that level of where you had this kind of legacy career. You know, some guys are still doing it, but, you know, working with Robin, who doesn't want to tour anymore, and realizing, like, wow, he's just not, even at his level, is very difficult. And then the True Fire thing came along, and that just kind of started taking on its own life. And I'm like, wait, I can stay at home. Mm-hmm. I can do gigs locally. I can do gigs that I want, and I can teach people from around the world due to technology. So I have students in Australia and in Europe, and I got a student in Japan. You know, like, so there's people from around the world. So that's really what it's been. It's been through teaching. And in the past year with the pandemic, the music business is, the guitar industry has exploded. You know, Fender can't make enough guitars. Mm-hmm. And so I've been fortunate to have had my whole body in the online teaching for quite some time. So, and then working really hard to build my YouTube channel and being fortunately embraced by Tim Pierce and Rick Beato and Keith Williams at 5 Watt World. You know, these friends now, it's been good. So it's really, it's been okay.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And do you do remote session too, or is that just online teaching, either one-to-one through Skype or FaceTime and TrueFire?
And TrueFire, yeah. And I'm working on a subscription channel as well. But there's so many things I can, only so many things I could do at once, you know. Yeah. Building the YouTube channel has been the main thing, and I'm putting out some other courses. I just put out a TrueFire course. I'm working with Brett Papa on another course.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's going to be a bit more rock-oriented. And, and then the idea of building a subscription channel coming up, but it's just me in my place in Brooklyn at this desk in front of this camera.
Yeah.
All day.
Okay.
You know? So I don't want to sound like I'm complaining, but it's still, you know, it's an interesting world. I was talking to Josh Smith about it as well. And he was more pushing towards touring. And now he's doing the same thing. He's like, wow, this is really quite a change. I mean, he was surprised as well. He's like, but it's actually, I'm surprised at the demand that people have for this. And I said, yeah. And, so for me at this point, I'm happy with this. And then playing gigs, the ones that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I don't want to go, I can't traipse around Europe anymore with pickup bands. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, it's so expensive to tour on the, yeah, I see what you mean.
And I miss the gigs though, and the people. I miss that, sure. Yeah.
And it's it has been, I think, a very interesting 2020 year. Of course, a lot of dramatic events and so on, but I think it also brought a lot of positive change. And you just mentioned Josh Smith, and I watched a couple of his interviews, and not only he's a super awesome musician, I had the pleasure to do a couple of interviews with him, but he's a great interviewer. So, and it's always super interesting when you have a great musician talking to another musician, because it creates a completely different kind of interview that I would be able to do because I am not a pro musician. So he's doing some great stuff, and he has a subscription-based YouTube channel too. You know? So that's a good a good way to reinvent the musician business, yes.
And the funny thing is, when the pandemic first hit, that's when I started doing the YouTube thing. And I on my YouTube channel, I interview Robin and David Grissom and Joey Landreth and Josh. And, you know, so there, if you want to go check those out too, there's interviews with a lot of guitar players as well, which has been fun. And it's you know, those were a lot of fun to do. I just felt like after a while, interestingly, those people really were interested in those, but the teaching videos became the most watched ones.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, great. Okay. And I'll have people on occasionally. I've got, you know, Sonny Landreth is going to come on, and, you know, Sonny's a friend. And I've had Matt Schofield's a really good friend of mine. He's been on a few times. Just, hey, man, you want to come on and just hang out and online? And yeah, it's just fun. And I think it's been a good year for musicians in that sense.
Yeah.
Where if you're on top of these things and open to this, and I'm pretty pragmatic about the stuff, like, that ain't happening. I need to make something happen.
Yeah, it's not like we have any choice left. We have to find ways to work, to get on with our life and so on. So, yeah, I see what you mean. Well,
one thing I think people don't understand is how much work it is. Even Josh was saying, he's like, man, this is a lot of work. I'm like, as you well know, putting on...
Yeah, it's very difficult to make it good, to have a good light, good sound, good camera, and all the technical stuff to broadcast through the internet and so on. It's a lot of work, and it's something to want to do it, and it's something else to redo it well, and to push some high quality content that, like you do, or like Josh is doing, or Matt, or definitely.
Yeah, some people are like, oh, how are you doing that? And then I have guitar player friends who want to get into it, and I start going through it with them. They're like, whoa, this is a lot of work. And I'm like, yeah, everything's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, that if you do it well, it's going to be a lot of work. But I enjoy it, so I'm fortunate in that sense.
Mm. As a word of conclusion, what would be the word of wisdom you would like to share with a musician watching this? You must be super wise, right?
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah, sometime maybe. A few things. I think the main thing is just I have a lot of gratitude for where I am. You know, and I did I end up being where I wanted to be, like a rock star or something like that? I'm just grateful that I can play guitar for a living. Mm-hmm. You know, I've figured out a way to do it. And yeah, I just think being grateful for these kind of things, and it's very easy to go down the super competitive and angry angle of, oh, my career isn't happening, I should, and my, maybe it's my Scottish upbringing was like, well, then figure it out. You know what I mean? That really kind of stoic, well, if that ain't happening, mm-hmm. you need to do something else to make it happen. That and to be yourself. You'll never, there's, you know, I see you know a lot, I've discovered in interviews. There's one Robin Ford, and he's the best Robin Ford. There was one Steve Ray Vaughan, he was the best Steve Ray Vaughan. So don't chase your tail with that stuff. Mm-hmm. Just the guys we all love the most are the guys who sound like themselves. So that was a nice point to come through at some point in my life. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I sound too much like somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Jeff, thank you very much for your time.
I really appreciate it.
It was really awesome to have you on the show. So hopefully next time we'll meet, it will be either here in Paris at the showroom, or maybe when I will be finally able to come to Brooklyn, to New York, to produce some guitar event, or maybe to some guitar shows. Who knows? Maybe we will have some guitar shows back in 2021 or after, right?
I hope so. Yeah. I feel like there's going to be a big renaissance once this is over for music. I think people are really want to get out and do stuff. So hopefully it'll be a bit like the Roaring Twenties in that sense, mm-hmm. that people go out and really want to see live entertainment again. Mm-hmm.
If people want to get in touch with you, book a training session, buy your training course, what's the main point on the internet to get in touch with you?
JeffMackerlane.com. All my courses are available there, and you can contact me through my website. There's a contact sheet for lessons, or you just want to say hi. I try to answer everybody because I'm super appreciative. Like I said, if anybody who takes the time to email me, then I'm happy to talk back with you, and I really appreciate it. So yeah, JeffMackerlane.com. Mm.
And I can vouch that you answer all the people, because I contacted you through your website and you got back to me to organize this interview. So I can vouch that, yes, he's doing it.
And I thank you for the interview very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks, man. Bye.
Pour le prix d'un magazine, abonnez-vous à la chaîne Guitare pour accéder aux vidéos intégrales. For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.